Red light blinking on the camera? Is that, yes? Okay. Good. We are in the end of round one still. I expect us to be in the end of round one next week. Hopefully by Pesach, round one will be over. The all things, including Job, must bow to Pesach.
Are we going to have a class for this?
No, no. I think we are scheduled to be off on the March 31st already.
Yeah.
In other words, we're meeting today. We're meeting the 17th. We're meeting the 24th. But then we're off on the 31st, and we're off during Pesach, and then back after Pesach is over. So yeah, we missed 2 weeks. That's right. And then we continue until we're done with Job. Okay.
How many years do you think that's going to be?
It's going to be next year. It's not going to be this year, that's for sure.
Do you have a car for the summer?
No, Job doesn't do cottages.
Or maybe we can all move through the car.
Right. I don't think you can enjoy Job in that kind of atmosphere. I think this winter is really, Jobian, if you will. Yes. So, last week we did most of chapter 12, which is the beginning of his response to Tzofar and really to all three of his visitors. He began in sentences 1 to 13 by saying, "You are not enlightening me with your speeches." Eliphaz with his statement that there will be justice, you just have to be patient. Bildad with his statement that which you think is bad may actually be good. Tzofar with his statement that there is justice, you just don't have the information that God has that he uses to determine what is just. And all three of them with their encouragement to approach God. His statement is, you're talking to me as though I was a fool. That's not really helping, and it's not adding anything to my store of information. And he said, these so-called righteous people, the people who call out to God and God answers them, are mocking me. And he said, the wicked are the ones who are at peace, which was sort of a jab. The fact that you are at peace, Eliphaz, Tzofar, Bildad, doesn't mean that you're the good guys, because there are thieves who are at peace also. And then he continued in sentences 14 to 25 to say, God is indeed the mightiest, and he is the source of all destruction. And the last point that we had discussed was how he created this series of images of reversals in sentences 17 through really 24, 25, in which he talked about those who are elevated and those who are wise and those who are powerful all being cast down. And I brought in, even though we read it last week, the last source that we saw last week is now source 1 on the sheets you have in front of you, the quote from Ralbag, in which he says, the fact that the mighty are torn down is itself evidence that there's some hand running things. Whether it is God's hand or whether God put the constellations in charge, it's not the natural order of things that you should find someone who is a wise counselor who suddenly gives bad advice. The idea that you have a good ruler who suddenly makes a remarkable error. The fact that you can have a great warrior who suddenly stops fighting as a great warrior and instead makes some mistake, he said, is clearly a sign that that person is being torn down. Now, I had an additional couple of notes on these verses, these last two verses in chapter 12 that I wanted to return to. First, if you take a look at chapter 12, sentence 12, so if you're using the stone Tanakh, it is the very top of 1637. The top of 1637. It's chapter 12, sentence 12. So there, Job said, "Bishishim chokma v'orech yamim tivuna." In the elderly is wisdom, in those of long life is comprehension, is understanding. So he's saying that the elders have wisdom. Yes,
Debbie.
Interesting. Well, they're dealing with the problem that I'm about to note.
Okay.
That's the way I would. As I said in the beginning, and I've repeated, you know, off and on, there are multiple ways you can take these verses, and often I will choose one simply to provide a coherent image, recognizing that there are other ways to do it. But in sentence 12, he makes what sounds like a declaration, because it's in a series of declarations, that the elderly have wisdom. And as we explained it initially last week, we said this is a rebuke to Tsofar, who is young, saying to him, you think you know what you're talking about, or you think that divine wisdom is way above and beyond what human beings can achieve, but that's because you're just a kid. Bishishim chachma, in the elderly is wisdom, so far you should be listening to me and what I have to say. That was the way we took it last week. If you jump to sentence 20, we find him say, the second half of sentence 20, he says, when discussing what God does to people, v'tam zikenim yikach, he takes away the wisdom of the elderly. So which is it? Do the elderly have wisdom, or does God take it away? So the truth of the matter is, we could simply say the answer is both, because that's the truth of human experience. You know, realistically, you could have it in the same person also. A person can be wise and sage, and then they could experience dementia or whatever it is, and that's part of human experience. And that's one way to take it. I suppose what Debbie said from JPS is another way to solve the problem. Turn the first one into a question, and then you're fine. Which again, you know, we frequently see here in Job, and it's sort of fed into by sentence 11. You could read that which appears to be a declaration as a question. And you can explain the whole section that way. That's, you know, certainly a way to do it.
Wouldn't there be a hey before, like, ha bi shishim
chokhmah? Well, the thing is, in the previous sentence, 11 started with the hey. Hello, ozen milin tivchan. So you could just continue that question, you know, if you wanted, into 12. It's certainly a legitimate read.
Or is it a rhetorical question? Is that what it is? It seems sarcastic to me.
Right. Well, the question is, what does he mean then? That if you're going to read that as a question, I think the way to do it is to read it as an outgrowth of his previous questions when he said in sentence 9, "Who doesn't know all of this?" We know all of this. We know that in God's hand is the life of all living. Do you think that we actually have any understanding? Taking sentence 11 as a question, maybe rhetorical, of, you know, is the ear going to understand and so on, and do we really have wisdom? It's all, as he says in sentence 13, it's all with God. It's not my preferred read. I think it reads smoother if it's not a question, but that's just, you know, my take. But take a look at source number 2 on your sheets. The passage from the Talmud in Shabbat, towards the end of the volume of Shabbat. Talmidei Chachamim, Torah scholars, kol zman shemazkinin chokhma nitosefet bahem. When Torah scholars age, they gain wisdom. And they quote the verse that he had here in sentence 12. Bishishim chokhma, that in the aged is wisdom, va'orechimim tivuna, in long life is understanding. Ve'amei ha'aretz, but everybody else, amei ha'aretz can be a pejorative for those who are ignorant. It could also be a simple statement of lay people, normal people. Kol zman shemazkinim tipshut nitosefet bohen. When they age, they gain foolishness. And he quotes the other verse, Meisir safalan emanim v'tam zekinim yikach, that God takes away the comprehension of elders. So that what the Talmud is doing is it's resolving the contradiction by saying it's talking about two different populations. And saying that those who are not involved in Torah lose wisdom, those who are immersed in Torah develop their wisdom and flourish. Now, everybody knows, and we can all cite examples of people who were great Torah scholars and yet suffered dementia, and you know, didn't have this. The point is not, the Talmud is not trying to make a definitive statement about the fate of people. For that matter, there are plenty of people who have not studied Torah, who are very wise into an older age. It's not the point. The point is, how do we resolve two different verses? And here's a way to do it that is consistent with a Talmudic approach to the way that God treats people. And we find other verses like this. The most obvious one from Psalms, I think it's 89, Od yunuvun b'seva d'shanim v'rananim yehiu, that the righteous will continue to flower, continue to blossom in their old age, and they will still be fresh and rejuvenated. So that's an image that is that's being offered, and I bring it here only because it's an interesting way to resolve this, you know, pasuk yud bed versus pasuk chas, sentence 12 versus sentence 20. It doesn't take away from the readings that we've had. Yes?
How come there's an extra yud in
shishim?
Like,
where do you see an extra yud? Oh no, it's the word it is talking about is yishishim, and the bed is a prefix. Yishish is somebody who is elderly, who is aged. Yeah, it's not shishim 60. The be shishim. It's tricky because what happens is when you have the chiwik under the bed, the shva that should be under the yud, which would have tipped you off, disappears. So that's what makes that confusing. But it's be yishishim.
So, Gordon, could it possibly be, you know, you said sometimes you can make the shin and sin. Did you ever say that?
Or yeah, no, the sin and the samach.
Oh, you can't do a shin and sin.
Shin and sin can happen also, but it's a little weird.
So could it be, like, yes, he's like people who are happy, have the chachma, and then later zikanim are the ones, the elderly, the ones, like, could be two completely different people.
It's an interesting idea, but I wouldn't know a basis for doing that.
Okay.
Yeah. The word yeshish in general is a tough word. Dan Mikra floats the idea in a footnote that maybe it's like tash kocho, to have one's strength drained. So the yeshish is somebody who is drained.
There's a word kashish.
Kashish with a kuf.
Yeah.
Right, that we have, but the kuf is part of your root.
Right, but that means elderly. You know,
right, right. It's also, I think, an Aramaic term rather than true Hebrew. I don't know what true Hebrew means, so maybe that's not a term I should use. But it's a term that we find Talmudically. Kshishim or kshisha as it's used. I don't know of a place in Tanakh, although it could be there. Yeah. So that's interesting. So they're actually using that as the as a translation for Yeshishim, they're using it. Okay. To return to my initial question that I asked last week in the beginning of this chapter, is there anything they could have said that would have made Eov happy, that would have made Job happy?
They could have sympathized.
They could have sympathized.
Said, this is really terrible for you,
right.
Et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
That would have made him happy with them, not with God, but with them.
Correct. If their mission had been, we want to ease his suffering, then they could have done that. But because their mission is, we have to educate him, rehabilitate him in terms of his relationship with God, because we see this as a means of getting him out of his suffering, forget it. There's no way they can accomplish that, because in his suffering, Job is convinced, and he made it clear yet again all through chapter 12, he is convinced that God is the source of devastation. Total, complete, permanent, regardless of people's worth. And simply saying to him, but it's not true, or that's not my experience, or you don't understand, it's like banging your head against a brick wall. That's not where he is. He's not ready for that kind of a conversation. His responses are flat out refusal of what they're saying. He's not giving them any inch. There's no like, well, this is true, but not interested.
Well,
not buying it.
In the anguish stage of grief. I mean,
oh yeah.
This is grief. He's really been let down. A very important entity. This
yes.
Huge loss. The biggest loss.
Right. No, and he's absolutely, absolutely, completely, and totally in the rage. Yes.
But he was angry when they were quiet too.
Yeah.
So maybe this process of him being angry at them is part of, I don't know what's going to happen at the end, but maybe it's part of the process that will bring him to the end.
Yeah, not so much.
To make himself a punching bag for somebody who's angry.
Right. So that's an interesting, it's an interesting idea. I wish it were what happens here. But I will say, his anger when they're silent is consistent with his anger when they speak. Because what he's looking for, I think, is commiseration. And he doesn't view their silence as commiseration. That's the way I would look at it. Shana?
I was just going to say that it's important to your point, the explanation of the relationship between Connor and Tina. And it says, you know, went out of the way to make her angry. And I think that Mara talks about the idea that the ultimate outcome of that was that Connor was forced to break. So that she had to be dislodged from her situation, and Tina was the instrument.
Right, the Talmud does try to redeem Penina by suggesting that, you know, when Chana cannot have children and Penina has children and they're co-wives, as the text says, that the kiasata tsarata gamkas, she makes her angry ba'avur har ima, for the sake of creating ram in her, and ram is thunder. The making her thunder is the goal of Penina. So the Talmud sees in that an altruistic motive, that she wants Chana to pray, and this is the way she's going to do it. I mean, Chana and Penina, I'm good. These three, I have a harder time.
I think if they would validate his anger, it would help. If they think, we understand why you're so angry. This is, you know, that would help.
Mm-hmm. Right. There's been no stage of, boy, we see that this is that what's happened to you is awful. We haven't seen that here. And again, as we've said any number of times, assuming this really happened and it's not a parable, we're not getting the entire story of their conversations. For all we know, there was such a thing. But from the fact that the book doesn't give it to us, I don't know if I would say it's probably not there, but that means the author doesn't think it's significant for us. That it doesn't really relate to how he does this or how he responds.
These people are called friends. These are friends.
Loosely.
No.
They're a different kind. These are like Facebook friends. Yeah, like they know he exists.
It's not like a friend.
It cost me something. Maybe it's Ra'im and not Ra'im.
Yes?
Do you think that Job wanted to hear them, maybe not so much sympathize or empathize, but to give him the acknowledgement that he was a good person? Do you think that that's sort of what he wanted? That would make him, is that sort of what he's looking for? Because when they try to say, we understand, he's like, I don't understand. So I'm wondering, does he just
right.
want to hear, like, maybe some...
Well, if that's what he wants, it puts them in a very difficult position. Right? Because Job, I think, what he really wants is for them to say what he is saying. Which is to say, Job is good, and what's happening to him is unjust. And that puts them in the very awkward position of having to say something they don't believe. It's one thing for them to validate his suffering and say, wow, this is awful and terrible, and I can't imagine what it's like. And you can say all of those things without making God the villain. The moment you say, Job, you're wonderful, you're really implying, and what's happening to you is grossly inappropriate, and that steps over a line. And so I don't know that I would have demanded that of them. But what I would have demanded of them, frankly, is, you know, the sensitivity to say, what's happened to you is awful. And none of them introduced their remarks with any such comment. They all begin with something like Tzofar begins with, I have to speak, I can't be silent, this is such blasphemy against God, and someone's got to speak up. Like, come on, pal. Really? That's your opening comment? Not, we've been living in your house for a week, thanks for the food. Something. Okay. Let's take a look at chapter 13. Chapter 13 is also really, really remarkable in frankly, a lot of ways. We're not going to see the whole thing. But we're going to see Job turn the picture such that he's going to claim, I am the faithful one, and you visitors are the faithless ones. I am the true servant of God, and you, with your flattery of God and your image of how God works and all of that, are actually worshippers of what we call in Hebrew Avodah Zarah, idolatry, foreign gods. So there. That's what he's going to put forth here in chapter 13. The opening part of it is sentences 1 to 12. And you'll see on the sheet, I use a lot of Malbim here because what he had to say here was so on point. It's not that it's exclusively his point of view, but the way he expresses it is so perfect that I use a lot of Malbim here in the sources. He begins with sentences 1 and 2, and again we're on page 1637 in the Stone Tanakh. He says, Hein kol ra'asa eini, shama'a ozni vataven la. All of this, and when he says all of this, he means everything that you have told me or everything that I have reported on, the ways in which God destroys, that which I just finished chapter 12 with, all the ways that God is destructive. Rasaini, my eyes have seen it. Shama'a ozni, my ear has heard it. Vataven la, and has understood it. Kidatchem yodati gam ani. Just like your knowledge, I know this. Lo nofel anochi mikem. I am no less than you. To a certain extent, this is a throwback to his comments in the beginning of chapter 12, in which he said, you're not telling me anything I don't know. But this is stronger than that. Malbim sees here an added rejection of Tsofar's point. When Tsofar said that God's wisdom is beyond us and we can't understand it and all of that, so what he's doing here is responding to that. If you take a look at source number 3, I brought you Malbim's formulation. He says, Lo tuchal lomar sheseichel ha'adam eino masig ha'emet. He says, you can't tell me that a person's mind cannot grasp the truth because it only grasps that which it senses and not the truth of things. Because I have grasped all of this with my senses. And you can't tell me that, well, it, because it's what I saw, my eyes have tricked me. Ki kein shama azni, because I've also heard it as well. And when he says I've heard it, what he means by that is he's heard it from other people. Other people have made the same observation that he is making. So it's not just him. Acheis barerli shagam anashim acherim ra'us hamarek kemoshiri isiya anochi. It has become clear to me that other people have seen it as I see it. You can't tell me that everybody is being fooled such that they all see the same delusion. You know, we can all be delusional, but we're all going to be delusional differently. We're not going to all be delusional the same way, he argues. Now, whether that's true or not is a good question, but that's his statement. But he continues. The gam vataven Allah, he says, my ear heard it and understood it. The imkain eino dimyon v'taud. It's not just an imagination. It's not just a mistake. Rak hasagam yitit. It is a true comprehension. V'gam lo tuchlu lomar. He's going through clause by clause in sentences 1 and 2. V'gam lo tuchlu lemor sha'atem masigim et hadvrim ba'ofen acher mima she'isakti ani. And don't tell me that you understand things differently than I do. Ki adat shalachem mishuneh midati, because your minds are different from mine. Ki kidatchem yadati gam ani, because I know as you do. Right? That next clause that he used. V'gam lo tuchlu lomar shal kapayim da'atchem gedola u'gvoha midati bekamut, and don't tell me that you're just smarter than I am. V'hasagatam gedola me'asagati, and that their understanding is greater than mine, or perhaps it should be hasagatchem. Maybe there's a typo, is greater than mine. Kilo nofel anochi mikem, I am no lower than you. Don't tell me that you get it, and that I am the one who's somehow missing it. Because I understand everything that you understand. In other words, don't tell me that this is all beyond human wisdom and understanding. It's in my senses. It fits what everybody else says. I comprehend it. And therefore, I insist that what I am saying is right, and what I have in my corner, to my advantage, is the fact that I am pursuing truth. And that brings us to Psukim Gimel and Dalet, sentences 3 and 4. Ulam, but, he says, Ani El Shakai Adaber, I will speak to God. And there, once again, is that name, Shin, Dalet, and Yud, for God, that we've seen quite a bit in this book. Malvim is going to comment on that name in a moment. He says, I am speaking to God. And I want to educate God. L'hochiach, we've used this word before, is to educate, but in a harsh way. It's usually associated with rebuke. Really demonstrating that one is right and that the other is incorrect. He says, that's what I want to do. You. V'ulam atem, but you. Tofle shaker. Tefel or tafel is a term that we use for something that is subsidiary to something else, but it's also a term that we use when you want to describe sort of putting a layer on something. Like imagine that you were lining something with lime or with pitch or something like that. It's that kind of a layering that you would do with this, to smear something on. So he says, you're smearing on lies. And then he uses a very funny turn of phrase. I'm curious how your translations render it. Rofei Elil Kulchen. What is Rofei Elil in your various translations?
Worthless healers, all of you.
Worthless healers?
Quack, forgers of lies.
Forgers of lies?
Quack, same word.
It says quack in there?
Yeah,
really?
This is modern, eh?
Wow.
Well, that's the same.
Yeah. Excellent. Literally, Rofei Elil could be rendered as witch doctors. Rofei is a doctor, Elil being an idol, an empty god. But that's not the way most translators take it. But in general, what he has said in these two sentences is, I pursue truth while you pursue lies. I will speak to God, because frankly, it's useless speaking to you. That's essentially what he's saying. And Dat Mikra adds, you are the wicked ones because you're promoting falsehood regarding God. So what is Rofei Elil? Four different approaches that I've seen. Dat Mikra does not like the witch doctor read, unfortunately. I liked it, but Dat Mikra does not. Rashi and Mitzudat David take it as Rofei Al, Aleph Lamed, but with the A under the Aleph, the Patach. And Al means a negation. It is not so. Rofei Al, doctors not. As in, you are non-healers. Your prescription is irrelevant for me. Rashi, Mitzudat David take that approach. Rashi also quotes a midrash that the word Elil is related to the word Alal, Aleph Lamed Lamed, which is found to refer to a sinew in the body. Alal is like a gid. And so the idea is that there's a particular sinew that is unhealable. Once it's broken, that's it. And so the Rofei Elil is someone who claims they can heal this thing that can't be healed. You think you can heal the unhealable. And then Ralbag adds to that the idea that Elil is like dal, something weak. And so he says you are poor healers. That's another approach to it. The bottom line, however you read it, is you don't have any healing. All you bring to the table is falsehood. Take a look at source number 4, where Malbim crystallizes it. He says, "Hachiluf shebeini uveinechem, the difference between me and you, mashadatchem bilti maskim ledati, such that you do not agree with me." It has nothing to do with how bright you are and your ability, your comprehension versus mine. It has nothing to do with the one who is comprehending either. Rakbam, meaning in terms of me being righteous or wicked or whatever it is, it's not about that. רק בא מצד התכלית והאמצעים אשר שמנו לנו למטרה בוויכוחנו. He says, it's about our purpose and the means we have set as our goals. Meaning, your goal is to defend God at all costs and your vision of who God is. You have in your head that God is righteous and justice happens and everything is good. And so you will say whatever you need to say in order to reach that conclusion. And any evidence that's presented to you, your immediate goal is to find a way to interpret it to support your view of how the world works. In other words, you're human beings. That's what human beings do. But he says, that's not me. Not me. My goal is to teach God a lesson. And that's why you and I are coming to this from different points of view. Because I am looking at it the way it is. The only way it is. And therefore, I am honest and forthright, and I have no reason to color existence. You sort of wonder, or I sort of wonder at any rate, what if, after he said this sentence, sort of the sun came out, and everything was bright, and his kids came back, and everything was all beautiful, you know, you sort of wonder, would he still be angry at God and saying, I still believe that the world is not good, and so on? Or would he go back to the Eov we knew in the beginning of the book? Debbie says no.
No. Look what's happened to him. Look what he's gone through. Thanks a lot. You know, did you need to put me through all this? Yeah.
So that's a question. Would he say, nonetheless, there's been suffering all along, and therefore God has something to answer for?
Yeah. I mean, this isn't like breaking your fingernail.
Right.
His kids are dead, and that's what I keep focusing on. Not his crops, not his awful wife, nothing. Dead children. There's nothing.
Right. I mean, in my hypothetical case, the kids come back to life. Not new kids, but the same kids. But nonetheless, the suffering he's gone through for this, however long this has been. Understood. I'm just curious.
You said something about teaching God a lesson. Where did you get that from? I thought he wanted to know why this done.
So at some point, he has shifted gears. Really, once he shifted, going back to after Bildad's speech, he shifted into wanting to sort of quarrel with God in court.
Yes.
That's
not teaching him a lesson.
Pointing out injustice as opposed to asking, is this justice, is the distinction I'm trying to draw. In other words, asking God, why did you do this, is where he was in the beginning. But at some point he shifted gears to asserting, no, it is unjust, and that's what I'm bringing God on charges for, so to speak. And the terminology that he uses here is what I draw on when I say teach God a lesson, because the term that's used in the Hebrew in sentence 3 of v'hocheach el kel, right? L'hocheach is a term for teaching.
When the I don't know what your JPS said, but mine had said argue.
Oh.
Well,
argue is not a good translation.
Yeah.
No, I think that's a flawed translation. In the Torah, when we... Right. Right. Now, we have a mitzvah in the Torah of lo tisnat achicha bilvavecha, don't hate your brother for his wrongdoing. In your heart, hocheach tochiach et amitecha, you shall, and then lochiach is either educate or rebuke. But it's clearly, either way, it's an educational function. The only question is, how harsh is it? The word lochiach that's used in sentence 3 really indicates he wants to educate God.
So he wants to teach God what the right thing to do is?
Or teach God that what's currently happening is wrong.
Well, that's the same.
I'm not sure that that's true. I think there's such a thing as teaching the negative versus teaching the positive. I'm not sure how good a teacher he is. But the point stands that he has gone beyond asking why, and he's already decided on what the why is. The answer to the question of why is either God is a brutal judge, and he's judging me for things, even fine points that are beyond human perception, that don't make sense for God to be attacking me for, or that God has outsourced the universe to the stars, and in so doing created a supreme act of injustice, because now it doesn't matter what you do, you're predetermined to experience whatever negative fate befalls you. So either way, he has already made his decision about where justice is. He has stopped questioning, and his verdict is in. He's very much prosecutor. That's the way I see what's happening here. So he has said, I pursue truth. I don't pursue the lies that others do. And he says in sentences 5-7, what you say about God is fundamentally wrong. He says, Mi yitain hacharish tacharishun usihi lachem lechochma. He says, it would be really good if you guys would just be quiet. And he says, that would be wisdom for you. As Mitzudat David says, the more you speak, the more foolish you sound. If you would be silent, somebody might think you wise. Pirkei Avot, but before Pirkei Avot, it is? What book in Tanakh that's closely related to this one? Well, it could be it's in Mishlei. Kohelet is the one I'm thinking of. Right? The fool walks along and tells everybody that he is foolish. Right, by the way he speaks. If people would only be silent, right, that's the Mark Twain line also. Right? How does it go? Better to be silent and thought a fool than to open your mouth and confirm it. Right? But what he's saying here is, if you're quiet, people actually, will think better of you. It's because you're speaking that you're conveying this foolishness. Which, even though, as we said, he wasn't happy during that first week. But yes, Job has, whatever he's lost in this, he's retained the one-liners. That he's got. If you take a look at source number 5, and there you do get the Mishlei reference. He makes the Proverbs reference in number 5. He says what we call in learning Gemara, Lishitascha, within your view. Okay? So he says, your whole point to me is, and yours is really so far, your whole point to me is that the human mind can't comprehend why things happen. So he says, well, in that case, it would be good for you to be silent. Since you don't get it either. Kederach gam evil machrish chacham yechashev. And that's the pasuk from Mishlei, from Proverbs. A silent fool is considered wise. V'zayah nachshav lachem l'chochma. So that would have been considered wisdom for you. Ki omer eini yodeya chochma sahu shiachrish v'lo yitvakeach. He says, if a person says, I don't know, then it's better for him to stop talking. Right? That would be the idea. That's not going to happen. Just to let you know, there is a round 2, there is a round 3, the book isn't ending here. but that's his advice, right? To the fellow at the bottom of the hole, stop digging. Right? That's what he's trying to say. He says, you're not supposed to be quarreling with me about this. And then he moves into sentence 6, back in Eov, back in Job. And he says, Shim'una tochachti. He says, hear my, and there's that word again, tochacha, right? Which again is this term for a kind of harsh educational style. Virivot svatai hakshivu. And listen to the revote of my lips. That's a very, very important loaded word. What is a riv? Well, how is it used usually? In what context? I didn't bring it on the sheet. I really should have.
Legal?
Sorry?
A legal context?
A legal dispute. When the Torah presents us the rules of court, it says, Ki yihye riv bein anashim. When there is a riv between parties, v'nikshu el hamishpat u'shpatum, they shall go to the court, and the court will judge them. Riv is a term we associate with litigation.
It's also, the twins were also, I think the word was also...
What do you mean?
In Rifka's...
By Yitro Tzitzu.
But it wasn't, there was no...
No, I don't think so. There's Rav Yavot Zair there.
Okay.
Yeah. Riv is a word associated with charges. I think it's Hosea who says, Rivu b'imchem rivu. The quarrel with your mother there in Hosea represents the Jewish people, but there it's in the sense of she has committed an injustice, and therefore you should quarrel with her. The riv is really a term we associate with charges. So he says, listen to what I have to say, to the charges I am bringing. Hale'el tedabru avla velo tedabru remiyah. And here's where he shifts into saying, what you're telling me is faithless. What you're telling me is not about God at all. He says, will you speak of corruption on behalf of God? That opening word is a very interesting one. Ha-le-kel. The Aleph Lamed at the end is a term for God. Ha is a question word, question prefix. Le can mean to. Will you speak corruption to God? But the commentators take it as on behalf of God. Rashi, Ralbag, Mitzudat, David, Malbim are universal in this. They're all agreed. Unanimous, I should say. You speak corruption on behalf of God when you justify God's deeds. Take a look back on the sheets, please, at source number 6. Halakel to the Abu Avla, Malbim says, Kivein al shitat Eliphaz ubildad shem yichasu avla elakel. He was referring to the views of Eliphaz and Bildad because they attribute corruption to God. What do you mean? Sheyanish onesh kaved ba'avur chet kal ledat Eliphaz. Because Eliphaz said there is justice in this world. There is punishment, and there will be reward as well. And what he said was, sometimes a person may have done something very small, but God is going to punish them closely because of what they deserve on their level and who they are. Well, he says, I call that corruption. He says, what you're doing is you're ascribing corruption to God. Or Bildad's view, that a person will suffer something bad so that he might in exchange get something good in the end. Well, did you ask the person first? He says, that also I reject as corruption. Not everybody wants to make that trade. So he says, accepting your view, within your view, you're telling me that God is corrupt. He's not willing to accept. It's not only a denial of the reality they portray, but it's a statement that even within your view of reality, it's an unacceptable form of conduct. Your version of God, to put it differently, your version of God is no more religious than mine. Your version of God is no more faithful than mine. That's his very strong response. And he then says, following this through, sentences 8 to 11, he says, I have news for you. God's going to rebuke you for this. You think that you're going to get away with this. Pasuk Ches, sentence 8. Hapanav tisaun im lakel terivun. Are you going to get God's favor this way? You are going to be Rav, right? Terivun. You're going to be God's defense attorneys. You're going to be the ones who are going to speak on God's behalf. Sorry, in Canada there are no attorneys. Defense lawyers. I apologize. But the term that he used, notice the term that he used in the beginning of the sentence. Nisi'ut panim. Remember what we said from Nusim back in chapter 11, sentence 15. Intimacy. You claim, or you're looking for an intimate relationship with God because you have justified God's conduct. He says, "Tell me something." Pasuk Tet, sentence 9. Hatov ki achkor etchem. Would it be good if you had that intimacy with God? Would it be good if then God would investigate you? In kasel be'enosh ta'asei luvo, if you are going to mock God the way that you mock a human being with your responses, hitul, hasel as it is here, is a term for making light of somebody, mocking somebody. Schok v'hitul is an expression. He says, hocheach yochiach etchem. There's that word again. God is going to rebuke you. He is going to educate you. Imbas, and double, the doubled verb, indicating more strength. Imbaseser panav tisaun, if you are going to try to gain that intimate relationship with God. Did you think you were going to get away with it? Did you think you were going to be close with God? Oh, no. That what comes in as part of that is divine rebuke. Halo se'eso teva'es eschem. The word se'et is a hard word. Rashi and Rabag render it as greatness here. Like to be no se' is to elevate something. So God's elevation, his exaltation, will frighten you. Rashi also has, and Ibn Ezra has, and Sudat David has, the word se'et rendered as fire. It's another possible read. Either way, what God is going to do is going to frighten you. Ufachdo yipol aleichem, his terror will fall upon you. Zichron eichem mishle efer. And all of your words, zikaron doesn't only mean memory, it means to mention something as well. So that which you have mentioned, mishle efer, are parables of ash. And that fits if se'et is fire, you know, then just reduced to ash. Legabei chomer gabeichem. That's a hard clause to translate, the end of that. Legabei chomer gabeichem. Curious, how do your, which ones, there are a couple of different approaches. I'm curious to see which ones yours take. Your what, I'm sorry?
Your stature to lumps of clay.
Statures?
Stature.
Your stature is lumps of clay, okay. What else do we have?
Responses are
after the responses.
Unsubstantial.
Okay, but the ending of, well, it is. It's slang. Once you can put in quack, you can do whatever you want.
Your responses are unsubstantial.
Okay, but the end of the sentence?
That's it. Your briefs are empty platitudes, your responses are unsubstantial.
So I don't know what they're doing then in this sentence. I don't know how to fit that in with the Hebrew.
The next comes, keep quiet.
That's the next sentence. Yeah, I don't know. So I don't know how to read that. The word gav is often, I mean, usually we use the word gav to mean the back of something.
To
support, but ech. Oh, that's michot shalachem, like you're lending your back into something to support it. That's an interesting idea. Rabbagim and Sudat David take gav as goof. And Radak takes it as gova, which is height, and that's where stature would fit in. But he says it's all clay. It was ash, which suggested the non-substance in the first half of the sentence, and chomer is just clay and material, which is interesting also because he's talked about himself as clay in God's hand, and he's used that term chomer.
But you said we read also gibul. Gibul comes from the word gav.
That's to collect.
Gibui
is collection.
No. Gibui is a matem tmicha.
Oh, gibui as in to give support. So that's back, right?
Okay.
Right. Right. Okay. So maybe that's the way to do it. Okay. I don't know. It's the whole thing is a bit odd to me, that clause, and I think the mix of views among the commentators reflects the difficulty of how to take that clause. But then, what he has now said, and what we've accomplished today, is that he says God is going to punish you for misrepresenting him. I know what I've seen, and I've heard it from others, so it's not just me, and it's in my comprehension, it's not just the evidence of my senses. And bottom line, I am pursuing truth while you are just trying to lie to justify your vision of how God works. And I have news for you, because it's not how God works, and God doesn't like it when people say things about him that aren't true. You think you're going to become close to God? You're going to be intimate with God? Intimacy with God is the last thing you want. Because when you're close to God, then God punishes you, because God looks at you closely. And so what will end up happening is you're going to suffer for the lies you've told and for any other, you know, any other inadequacies of yours. God's going to tear you apart. Then he shifts in sentences 13 to 19, which we'll start on. We're not going to finish it. But in sentences 13 to 19, he says, I, for my part, I am going to speak truth regarding God. And in this, my faith is going to be evident in the truth that I speak regarding God. We begin with Psukim Yud Gimel Yud Dalet, sentences 13 to 14 here, in which he says, I shouldn't be silent, you should be silent. Ha'charishu mimeni, va'adabra ani, v'yavor alai ma. He says, be silent from me, I will speak, and whatever happens, happens. Whatever comes to pass will be. Now, this pasuk should sound familiar to anyone who has said the keynote on Tisha B'Av. Well, in Hacharish Tacharishi, right, the term to be silent, true. But one of the keynotes, one of the elegies of mourning of Tisha B'Av, takes this sentence as its opening line. The only difference is that it begins many instead of many, I think maybe in some of them. Oh, it takes out the ani. But it's the opening line of an elegy for the Jews murdered in Germany during the Crusades. In the communities of Worms and Speyer and Magenta, that's what we're talking about. So this keynote begins with this sentence of "Be silent from me, and I will speak whatever happens to me." And what it's saying here, what it's saying there, is I need to speak of my suffering. Don't tell me to be quiet. I need to talk about what I've experienced. But what it's taking from Job is, in context here in the book, is no matter what God is going to do to me to punish me, I have to speak. Now, Malbim sees a very interesting subtext here, which is something that I really hadn't noticed. But take a look at source number 7. He says, "Achar shekoma shedibartem lahatzdik et hakel hayarak mitzad hayirah v'hapachad." Lo mitzad ha'emet. He attributes motive to them in a way that I hadn't really seen before. He says, everything you've said to justify God is because you're afraid that if you don't, he's going to punish you. You don't really believe what you're saying. You, at the bottom, believe what I say. But you're afraid to say so. And you're afraid to allow me to say so. Because you're afraid God's going to zap you in the event that you say such a thing. So, really, he says, "Im kein mi hechriaches chem ledaber." So who asked you to speak? Halokvar yisem yotzim yidei chovaschem yisem shotkim. He says, you could have accomplished your responsibility, fulfilled your duty to God, had you just been silent. No one was forcing you to silence me. Just don't express what I say and you'll be safe. That's his statement. His Malbim understands what he's saying. And he says, Alma Esa, sorry, just making it up for myself here. Alma Esa Bisari Bishinai Vinafshi Asim Bichapi. Why should I lift up my flesh in my teeth? And what he's describing is a person who's muzzling himself by biting his arm, you know, that type of an image. Like, why should I bite my tongue? Would be, you know, the way we would talk about it. V'nafshi asim b'chapi, holding my soul in my hands, not speaking. And then he says what is one of the most loaded and difficult sentences in the entire book. But in and of itself, it's worth reading this sefer just to get to this pasuk, just to get to this one sentence. He says, "Hein yikteleni lo ayachel." Ach derachai el panav ochiach. Now, that first half of the sentence is a big problem because the word lo is written with an aleph, but we're taught to pronounce it as though it was written with a vav. Now, the way we pronounce Hebrew, you can't tell the difference. I will say the word lo twice, and I will tell you the first one was the aleph and the second one was the vav, but it could just as easily be the opposite. I'm not going to get caught up in the question of how do you pronounce it differently, because it's not the point. When they told us to pronounce it this way, what the sages were saying is, that's the true word. Even though it's written with an aleph, it should be read as lo with a vav. Now, you'll ask me, what's the difference? What is a lo with an aleph? What is a lo with a vav? And the answer is, all the difference in the world. Lo with a vav means for him or to him. With the way it's written with the aleph, it's not. Okay? So it's the difference between saying, even if he kills me, for him I will hope. That's the way it's supposed to be read. As opposed to the way it's written, which is, if he kills me, I will not hope. Wildly different readings of the sentence.
But it's like also in Kohelet, when I forget the passage, that dead people can't praise God.
Well, there it's a question, or is it a state, or is it a statement? Right. But there, it's us trying to come to terms with a sentence which, if you read it as a sentence, presents huge problems. Here, this is a problem whichever way I read it, and because it's built into Masoretic text, it sort of comes off as more like, in the original, what was the intent, as opposed to how am I supposed to try to read this sentence? You know what I'm saying? It feels more like a contradiction in the text itself than a me trying to figure out what's going on. And maybe that's just my bias in how I'm reading what's going on in Koheles. But the way this sentence reads, what is he saying? What in the world is he saying? What is Job's statement here? I want the translations. I want to know what each of our translations says. Let's start with the art scroll with the stone. What do we have?
Were he to kill me, I would still yearn for him.
Were he to kill me, I would still yearn for him. So it's not a question, it's a statement. And it's very clearly the lo with the vav. I don't know what it means. If God kills me, I will still yearn for him. I don't know what that means. It's hard to yearn at that point.
And even if I know I'm going to be killed,
yeah,
it will not change my faith.
In other words, it's before. It's really, it's just poetic. But what he's saying is, I yearn for God. I have faith in God, even if he kills me. But then I want to know, what faith does he have in God, given how he's described God? What does he have faith in? So what is your, what does the Quack Tanakh say?
The Quack Tanakh says, with his old eyes...
This is great. I'm not going to forget this one.
Now, he may well slay me. I may have no hope.
He may well slay me.
I may have no hope.
So he's taking it the way it's written, not the way it's pronounced. Lo ayachel with an aleph. But no, but it's with the aleph in the way that they're reading it. I will not have hope.
You know what our scroll has here? Lo with an aleph in finer and fine print, and lo with a vav in bold print.
Well, that's because they're trying to show you the way it's written versus the way it's pronounced. They're trying to show you both. Yeah, in the current one.
It's with the vav in the margin.
Yeah. Right, and that's the way they usually note that. But what do they do in their translation?
Though he slay me with the lowercase h.
Yeah.
Yet will I trust him, in him.
Wait, with a lowercase h?
Yeah.
Do they normally capitalize the h for God?
I didn't notice it until...
No, I'm asking in this edition, in the current edition.
I have capital H, the same translation. Though he slay me, yet will I trust him.
Yeah, I have to think that the H... Is the H capitalized in him?
No.
Okay, so then I think they just don't capitalize H's.
No,
I see him,
it's not capitalized.
Yeah, it's never capitalized. Okay. But though he slay me, so that's reading it as with the vav. Though he slay me, I still have trust in him. I will trust in him. So I still want to know, what sort of trust does Job have in a God he has described this way? What is he trusting? Trusting what? I don't understand the sentence, and I'm not alone. The world has difficulty with the sentence. First of all, we don't know that he thinks that.
He says it's all for God.
Because he's saying this in chapter 13, but until now, he keeps saying it's either the stars or it's God doing something evil. Right, if I take that read of Job, then you're right. Then he's just trusting that bad things are going to happen even though he's been a good person. That doesn't help me.
But the second part of the sentence kind of changes.
Yeah. What does he say in the second half? Ach derachai al panav ochiach. But my path, my view of righteousness, I'm going to ochiach. There's that word yet again. Right? I am going to demonstrate, I am going to teach God that this path of mine is right. That I am the one who has it right, and that he is the one who has it wrong. So now I really want to know, what in the world is this faith that he's talking about? So guess what? That's what we're going to come back to next week. This sentence is just, you understand now why I built it up this way. This is a very, very hard sentence. But you can't understand the book without this sentence. I think there's so much about it that really comes down to this. So God willing, we resume next week.